Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Medea Benjamin, founding director of Global Exchange, who describes the conditions she witnessed among Afghan refugees while on a recent fact-finding mission to the region. Alice Slater of the Global Resource Action Center for the Environment, who critically examines the Bush administration's decision to withdraw from the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty. And Lucius Walker of IFCO Pastors for Peace, who talks about the first shipment of American food and medicine to be purchased by the Cuban government since the economic embargo was imposed almost 40 years ago. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez's populist program has run into obstacles as a business-led general strike shut down most of the South American country on December 10th. The nation's big business association, Fedecámaras, organized the 12-hour strike to show its opposition to new economic laws adopted by Chavez using emergency powers. The capital city of Caracas was mostly deserted, yet F-16 fighters flew overhead, drowning out the sounds of protesters banging pots and pans. Business groups are particularly upset with the new law that gives the Venezuelan government the power to seize large estates and other land that is considered unproductive. Since taking power in late 1998, Chavez has pushed an agenda to uplift the country's poor, including nearly half the country that cannot buy enough food to eat. According to the news magazine In These Times, Chavez wants to encourage more rural development to ease the overpopulation of Caracas and other coastal cities. The government has also moved to create 1,000 Bolivarian schools to provide students with quality education and 2 hot meals a day. Despite efforts to reduce poverty and flatten inflation, the educated middle class mostly opposes Chavez initiatives and so far have refused to participate in government-led development projects. Still, Chavez has many supporters like Don Julio Cesar, a cafe owner in the beach town of Santa Fe. He insists, "The people are learning. The economy is developing. This is not a violent revolution. It'll take time." In a historic human rights decision on December 11th, 10 members of a violent pro-Indonesia militia were convicted by a United Nations tribunal of committing crimes against humanity for the terror inflicted after a popular vote endorsing independence in 1999 in East Timor. The 10 militiamen now face prison sentences of up to 33 years for some of the worst atrocities in East Timor, where over 1,000 people died. The militia members were part of the Tim Alpha Gang, one of the many paramilitary units created by the Indonesian army in advance of the 1999 UN-sponsored vote in East Timor. According to the BBC, the gang attacked an aid convoy and killed 9 people, including 2 nuns, 3 priests, and an Indonesian journalist. In other cases, the UN panel consisting of judges from Brazil, Burundi, and East Timor have convicted militiamen of murder, rape, and torture, but this is the first case involving crimes against humanity. The panel is also investigating 700 murder cases, although some observers expect that number to grow. In the next few months, East Timor will finally become an independent state as the UN hands over the administration to local leaders. Longtime rebel leader Xanana Gusmão is expected to be elected as East Timor's first president. On September 14th, peace activist Elizabeth McAllister had not heard from her husband, Philip Berrigan, for more than a week. Berrigan is serving a 1-year sentence in a federal prison in Ohio for hammering on a military aircraft. Frantically, she called the federal prison in Elkton, Ohio, and her U.S. Senator, Maryland Democrat Barbara Mikulski. McAllister discovered that her husband, now 77, was placed into solitary confinement right after the September 11th terrorist attacks. Berrigan was prevented from contacting his family, but was released from isolation on September 21st. After pressed by Senator Mikulski, the Federal Bureau of Prisons conceded that Berrigan was put in solitary for security reasons and that the prison warden had halted all visitation and telephone calls to ensure the orderly running of the institution and to protect the public. According to the Progressive magazine, Berrigan was shackled and put in solitary right after the second World Trade Center tower came crashing down. Berrigan quipped, "Perhaps it was Ashcroft's idea. Lock up all the naysayers." Now, William Goodwin of the Center for Constitutional Rights estimates that 10 to 15 leftist prisoners were placed in isolation in the immediate aftermath of the September 11th terrorist attacks. In a startling move, these prisoners were prevented from talking with their lawyers. McAllister, a Baltimore pacifist, feels the lockdown was vindictive. She explained it was a punishment for acting against our love affair with the weapons of mass destruction. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In little more than 2 months, the U.S.-led campaign to topple the repressive Taliban regime in Afghanistan has succeeded. Intense fighting in the Tora Bora region decreased as al-Qaeda fighters were driven from caves and shelters in the mountainous region. But both the U.S. military and their anti-Taliban Afghan allies, who laid siege to the area from the air and on the ground, admitted they did not know the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden and other high-level al-Qaeda leaders. According to a report compiled by Professor Mark Harold of the University of New Hampshire, over 3,500 Afghan civilians have thus far been killed in the U.S. bombing campaign. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of Afghan refugees are without food, shelter, and medical care as harsh winter weather creates ever more dangerous conditions. Shipments of desperately needed food and clothing have been slow in reaching refugees in camps inside Afghanistan. One reason for the delay cited by humanitarian aid groups is the lawless conditions around the country, including bandits who attack food convoys, and the lack of any UN peacekeeping force to maintain order. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Medea Benjamin, founding director of the social justice group Global Exchange, who describes the conditions she witnessed among Afghan refugees while on a recent fact-finding mission to the region.
We just came back having visited about 7 different refugee camps, and seen lots of people who were anxious to get aid from UN organizations, but because of problems with the roads, particularly those who are in camps within Afghanistan, the food is not getting to the people that need it.
And what are some of the conditions that you saw among the refugees themselves?
Well, we saw a lot of dysentery, a lot of people, children who are malnourished, a lot of children that had no shoes or socks, no change of clothing, no warm blankets, families that had no decent tents to keep them out of the cold, no decent blankets. And it can get very cold in certain parts of Afghanistan where it's already snowing. So I would say the combination of not enough food and not a decent shelter of clothing puts many hundreds of thousands of people in a very precarious situation.
Because the U.S. and their Afghan allies have now virtually defeated the Taliban and al-Qaeda, the thought is that the aid will soon start flowing to those who need it the most. Is that something that you think is safe to assume at this point or not?
Well, I think it will be better than it has, but given that the roads are still unsafe, drivers are putting their lives at risk by taking in humanitarian aid, and aid workers are putting their lives at risk at distribution centers. So what is still needed is an international force to guarantee that the food gets to who needs it. Now, with the new government getting situated on December 22nd, and an international force that's supposed to be going to Kabul to protect that government, there's the beginnings of the international force in Afghanistan, but so far no provisions have been made for that same force to be protecting the different roads. So while the situation should improve with an end to the fighting, there is still no guarantee.
What are the obstacles standing in the way of getting those peacekeepers from various nations, I guess, as yet undecided? What's the problem in getting in there quickly so that the aid can start flowing?
The problem in the past month has been the United States. The United States has said they didn't want any other nation to send in a force, and there were about 5 or 6 nations ready to do so. That included France, Britain, Turkey, Indonesia, Bangladesh, and Jordan. But the U.S. said that having another international force inside the country would divert the United States from its focus on defeating al-Qaeda, and so the U.S. blocked that force. Now, the Northern Alliance, which is the majority force in the new government, is also reluctant to have an international peacekeeping force securing the roads because the Northern Alliance and the defense ministers from the Northern Alliance would like to be the ones in control themselves. Now, obviously, if they had the ability to control the situation, there wouldn't be a problem today, and there is a problem, so they can't control it. And everyone we talked to while we were there said that they wanted an international force, that they didn't really care what country was sending the troops, but they wanted someone to guarantee that there would not be this constant looting and banditry on the roads.
During your trip, did you learn anything more about the number of casualties, civilian and military, that have been claimed by the U.S. war in Afghanistan thus far? It seems that the U.S. media, the White House and the military really have said very little in the way of, how they phrase it, collateral damage. But we were talking about civilians and others who have been killed by the massive bombing in certain parts of the country.
We were very surprised from the day we got there and the day we got to Pakistan, really, of in the encounters that we had with people who had either lost a loved one, a member of their family, a neighbor, or themselves been physically hurt by the bombing. And as we encountered family after family, we realized that we were not talking about dozens of people, we're not talking about hundreds of people, but that this must be in the thousands. Now, people in the region were talking in the level of 2,000 to 3,000. Some of them said as high as 5,000, but nobody had an accurate picture. There is a U.S. professor who recently came out with a report saying about 3,700 people, and this is from a compilation of press reports that have come out in different countries around the world. So the numbers are probably over 3,000, and the numbers are probably, and we're talking about innocent victims here. We're not talking about soldiers who died in the fighting. But it probably is larger than the number of people who died at the World Trade Center. And let's remember that these people were every bit as innocent as the people who died in those towers.
That was Medea Benjamin, founding director of Global Exchange. Contact Global Exchange by calling 1-800-497-1994 or visit their website at www.globalexchange.org. After years of advocating that the U.S. withdraw from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, signed with the former Soviet Union in 1972, President Bush made the pullout official on December 13th when he provided Russia with the required six-month notice. Russian President Vladimir Putin, who had resisted U.S. pressure to jointly abrogate the treaty, called Mr. Bush's decision a mistake, but was generally positive about improving relations. China's leaders were also reported to have muted their criticism and accepted a White House invitation to high-level talks over the future of arms control. While the U.S. withdrawal from the ABM treaty was not unexpected, many international observers expressed concern that Bush's plan to build an anti-missile system could trigger a new global nuclear arms race. In particular, there is fear around the world that China will react by constructing more intercontinental missiles, setting off a buildup of nuclear weapons in neighboring India and Pakistan. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Alice Slater, president of the Global Resource Action Center for the Environment, about the U.S. withdrawal from the ABM treaty and her belief that this signals the Bush administration's intent to militarize and dominate outer space.
We are the most powerful nation on the earth, and what this is about is not about trying to defend ourselves against missiles, but about dominating and controlling the military use of space. It's about putting weapons up in space, and this technology has to be tested in order to militarize space. The U.S. Space Command has this document out, Vision 2020, that talks about dominating, controlling the military use of space to protect U.S. interests and investments. That's a direct quote. And the head of the Space Command was Richard Myers, who's now chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, put out a report in January of this year which echoes the Space Command that we have to take the high ground and be up in space. And nobody else wants to be there right now. As a matter of fact, there was a vote in the UN about 4 weeks ago where every country in the world voted to keep space free of weapons except the United States, Israel, and Micronesia for some reason. And so we are putting our national security in jeopardy, because if we go ahead with this so-called shield, China, for example, only has 18 long-range missiles that can reach us. We and the Russians have about 8,000 each that we're talking about now cutting back on. But China will feel compelled to build up more spears to overcome this shield, and then India and Pakistan will follow suit, and it will be a very dangerous game for this country. There is a whole tradition that when a president wants to withdraw from a treaty, they have to get Congress to approve it. I mean, the Constitution's silent on it. It says that the Senate must give a two-thirds vote to approve a treaty that a president negotiates. And, of course, it's been an open question whether a president could pull out of it. We have a whole history of presidents going to Congress. John Adams went to Congress when he wanted to get out of some entangling alliances with France during the wars in Europe, and Congress gave him approval to declare the treaty was concluded. And then President Polk wanted to withdraw from the Argonne Territory Treaty with Great Britain, and Congress obliged him with a joint resolution. Actually, it's interesting, the big change occurred in 1978 when Jimmy Carter, he unilaterally terminated our mutual defense treaty with Taiwan. And at that point, Senator Barry Goldwater brought a lawsuit in the Supreme Court asking them to maintain the checks and balances and to say this is illegal. And the court ducked the question. They said it was a political question. They didn't decide, so it's still an open question. And what's really interesting is that Barry Goldwater's brief was supported by Orrin Hatch, Jesse Helms, and Strom Thurmond at the time. So I think it would be very important for the Senate to stand up now and assert its authority and have a debate on whether we really want to go this route of militarizing space.
So what can the nations of the world who don't want to see the United States have this sort of preeminent, unchallengeable position of domination of outer space, what can they do?
I don't know what the nations of the world can do. I think Americans have to take back democracy. I mean, it's undemocratic for a president to give up this strategic arms control treaty, the anti-ballistic missile treaty that helped us to stop the nuclear arms race since the 70s. I mean, the president wasn't even elected legally. You know, there's certainly a question about how he took office. Now they're talking about military tribunals and cutting out all our civil liberties. And so there's like an undemocratic action going on in this country of a president acting like a monarch. And I think we Americans have to do something. I mean, we have to give a little spine to our senators and our congressmen. We have a balance of power in this country, but the Senate has been spineless.
Do you see the makings, Alice Slater, of a revival of a new peace movement that'll take on this challenge of trying to oppose the militarization of outer space? What do you see as the potential here?
I think the real potential is with the anti-corporate globalization people, because they are first beginning to make the links, which we've been trying to do, to explain over the last 2-3 years, between corporate and military power. I mean, Thomas Friedman, the columnist for the New York Times, he wrote a cover article in one of the Sunday magazines. It was about 2 years ago during the summer. It showed a clenched fist clad in the red, white, and blue of the American flag, and it said, for America to act like the almighty superpower it is, it has to have a strong military. And this is a direct quote. He said, we can't have McDonald's without McDonnell Douglas. And there's a growing awareness of the police power, the global cops, you know, that are backing up this corporate power. It's in Vision 2020 that we need this space weaponry to protect our investments. That's their direct language. So I think the energy is going to come from a confluence between the peace movement and the globalization movement.
That was Alice Slater, president of the Global Resource Action Center for the Environment. Contact the center by calling area code 212-726-9161 or visit their website at www.gracelinks.org. While much of America is focused on the U.S. war against terrorism in the Middle East and the capture of Osama bin Laden, history was made on Sunday, December 16th, when an American ship pulled into Havana Harbor. The vessel was carrying almost 60 million pounds of corn and medicine, purchased by the Cuban government to replenish supplies destroyed by Hurricane Michelle. The purchase was made possible last year when Congress passed legislation which would exempt food and medicine from the trade embargo, which made it impossible for Cuba to purchase American goods for the last 40 years. When the U.S. stipulated that all purchases by Cuba would be on a cash-only basis, Cuban President Fidel Castro responded by saying his country would not buy one grain of rice under those conditions, but stated that the recent purchases made were due to a state of emergency. For years, many farmers and big businesses in the United States have lobbied to end or ease the economic embargo. They consider this first transaction a victory, despite the hard line of the Bush administration against Cuba and the continued lobbying against any future relations between the U.S. and Cuba by right-wing anti-Castro groups in New Jersey and Miami. Lucius Walker is with the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization, or IFCO, and is the founder of Pastors for Peace. He spoke with your reporter, Denise Manzari, about this first food shipment and its implications for the future.
I would like to correct a news announcement which was made on one of the major networks, which said that the shipment was a humanitarian aid shipment from the United States. Nothing could be farther from the truth, and I'd like to give a little background. The shipment was a purchase by Cuba of, you know, $100 million plus worth of food and medicine. Last year, under the Clinton administration, a bill was passed which authorized the sales of food and medicine. But there were certain provisions which were totally unacceptable to the Cubans. They continued to have the requirement for end-use accountability, which is to say that there needed to be some description of how every aspirin or every specific item would be used, a virtual impossibility. And things stalled on that basis for quite a while. But the point I'm making is that after that hurricane, the U.S. made an almost insulting gesture to Cuba, saying, we'll send some aid to you, a very paltry sum. And the response, official response by Cuba was, we are not asking for your aid, but we are prepared to buy, preferably with normal terms, but if not, we'll buy with a cash payment. And that was worked out over a matter of weeks, and the result was the shipment, which was sent down through the Crawley shipping lines out of Jacksonville, Florida, which is licensed to ship such materials to Cuba. So the purchases were not just because Cuba is hurting, but I think those purchases are for two reasons. One, to restock their reserves, and secondly, as a way, I think very astutely, of initiating trade for the first time in the history of the Cuban Revolution with the United States. I think it was a very savvy move. But it's a way of beginning a historic opening that may lead to more normal relations down the line.
There have been major agricultural businesses in the United States for years that have been seeking to relax the embargo, to begin trade with Cuba. The hardliners in Miami have fought against that vehemently and were vehemently against this recent transaction.
Yes.
As well.
They opposed the passage last year of the food and drug legislation, and they didn't want the shipment to happen, but they lost.
They opposed it, but in the past have also denied that food and medicine was even ever part of the embargo.
Well, even the Cuba Democracy Act, which was supposedly authored by Robert Torricelli, who's now senator in New Jersey. On the basis of that legislation, it is alleged that food and medicines are not embargoed. That's another piece of falsification of the record.
What about Cuba remaining on the U.S. terrorist list?
I think it's one of the most silly, foolish positions taken by our government. Of course, everything about this blockade of Cuba is stupid and senseless. The right-wing elements in Congress and right-wing Cuban-American communities in Florida and the and New Jersey will try to keep Cuba on the terrorist list, but there are already the beginnings of some efforts in Congress to remove it from the terrorist list.
In the wake of a recent decision in Miami as well, the leader of a Cuban spy ring, Gerardo Hernandez, was convicted of trying to obtain U.S. United States military secrets and was sentenced to a maximum life sentence for two conspiracy counts and a total of, I think, almost 80 additional years for lesser charges.
Yeah.
How would you say that this either relates to this recent transaction and the whole situation of what happened in 1996 with the shooting down of Brothers to the Rescue planes, which is basically what he was convicted of?
These young men who were recently, the Cubans who were convicted, were doing a heroic service to protect their country against terrorist cells that were operating in and around Miami, Florida. If the U.S. itself had spies or patriotic citizens who had infiltrated Al-Qaeda or some other organizations that could have informed them about the intent to attack the World Trade Center, they would have saved lives. One of the criticisms the administration came under from retired members of the military and the intelligence community is that there should have been a human intelligence operations that would have discovered the plans to attack the World Trade Center. The U.S. didn't do that.
That was Lucius Walker of IFCO Pastors for Peace. For more information, call area code 212-926-5757 or visit the group's website at www.ifconews.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.